Unit 6. Text 1. Dull Work by Eric Hoffer. Text. There seems to be a great assumption that brilliant people cannot stand routine, that they need a varied, exciting life in order to do their best. It is also assumed that dull people are particularly suited for dull work. We are told that the reason the present-day young protest so loudly against the dullness of factory jobs is that they are better educated and brighter than the young of the past. Actually, there is no evidence that people who achieve much crave for, let alone live, eventful lives. The opposite is nearer the truth. One thinks of Amos, the sheepherder, Socrates, the stonemason, Omar, the tentmaker. Jesus probably had his first revelations while doing humdrum carpentry work. Einstein worked out his theory of relativity while serving as a clerk in a Swiss patent office. Machiavelli wrote The Prince and The Discourses while immersed in the dull life of a small country town where the only excitement he knew was playing cards with muleteers at the inn. Immanuel Kant's daily life was an unalterable routine. The housewives of Königsberg set their clocks when they saw him pass on his way to the university. He took the same walk each morning, rain or shine. The greatest distance Kant ever traveled was 60 miles from Königsberg. The outstanding characteristic of man's creativeness is the ability to transmute trivial impulses into momentous consequences. The greatness of man is in what he can do with petty grievances and joys, and with common physiological pressures and hungers. "When I have a little vexation," wrote Keats, "it grows in 5 minutes into a theme for Sophocles." To a creative individual, all experience is seminal. All events are equidistant from new ideas and insights, and his inordinate humanness shows itself in the ability to make the trivial and common reach an enormous way. An eventful life exhausts rather than stimulates. Milton, who in 1640 was a poet of great promise, spent 20 sterile years in the eventful atmosphere of the Puritan Revolution. He fulfilled his great promise when the Revolution was dead, and he in solitary disgrace. Cellini's exciting life kept him from becoming the great artist he could have been. It is legitimate to doubt whether Machiavelli would have written his great books had he been allowed to continue in the diplomatic service of Florence and had he gone on interesting missions. It is usually the mediocre poets, writers, etc., who go in search of stimulating events to release their creative flow. It may be true that work on the assembly line dulls the faculties and empties the mind, the cure only being fewer hours of work at higher pay. But during 50 years as a working man, I have found dull routine compatible with an active mind. I can still savor the joy I used to derive from the fact that while doing dull, repetitive work on the waterfront, I could talk with my partners and compose sentences in the back of my mind, all at the same time. Life seemed glorious. Chances are that had my work been of absorbing interest, I could not have done any thinking and composing on the company's time or even on my own time after returning from work. People who find dull jobs unendurable are often dull people who do not know what to do with themselves when at leisure. Children and mature people thrive on dull routine, while the adolescent who has lost the child's capacity for concentration and is without the inner resources of the mature, needs excitement and novelty to stave off boredom.
Text 2. Doing Chores by August Heckscher. I have been doing chores, being for a brief spell alone in a house that recently was astir with bustle and echoed with the voices of a gathered family. For those who may be in some doubt as to the nature of chores, their variety, their pleasures, and their drudgery, I am prepared to deliver a short disquisition. The first point about chores is that they are repetitive. They come every day or thereabouts, and once done, they require, after a certain time, to be done again. In this regard, a chore is the very opposite of a happening, that strange sort of event which a few years back was so much in fashion. For a happening was, in essence, unrepeatable. It came about in ways no one could predict, taking form from vaporous imaginings or sudden impulse. Chores, by contrast, can be foreseen in advance, for better or worse. I know that tomorrow I must be reenacting the same small round of ritualistic deeds, and they arise, moreover, from practical necessities, not from poetic flights. A second point about chores is that they leave no visible mark of improvement or progress behind them. When I am finished, things will be precisely as they were before, except that the fires will have been set, the garbage disposed of, and the garden weeded. In this, they are different from the works which, optimistically, I undertake. Ozymandias may have been presumptuous, but he was essentially right when he looked about him and said, "See how my works endure." A work, once achieved, leaves a mark upon the world. Nothing is ever quite the same again. The page of a book may have been printed, or a page of manuscript written, a sketch, a poem, a song composed, or perhaps some happy achievement reached in one of the more evanescent art forms, like the dance or cooking. All these have an existence of their own outside of time, and at least for a little while live on in the mind of their creator and perhaps a few of his friends. The well-meaning wife, seeing her husband about his chores, will miss the character of his performance. "Henry loves to cut wood," she will say. "He positively dotes on controlling the flow of waste from dinner table to compost heap." The wife is perhaps trying to appease an unnecessary sense of guilt at seeing her spouse engaged in mundane efforts. The fact is, he doesn't love doing chores, but neither does he feel humiliated or out of sorts for having to do them. The nature of a chore is that it is neither pleasant nor unpleasant in itself. It is entirely neutral, but it is obligatory. Neutral, and yet I must confess that with their repetition, and perhaps because of their very inconsequence, chores can in the end evoke a mild sort of satisfaction. Here, as in more heroic fields of endeavour, a certain basic craft asserts itself. To do what must be done neatly, efficiently, expeditiously, without rest and without haste, lights a small fire deep in the interior being and puts a man in good humour with the world. Santa Yana described leisure as being at home among manageable things. And if he was right, we who are the chore doers of the world are the true leisure classes. At least one can be sure that no chore will defeat us. None will raise insuperable obstacles or leave us deflated as when the divine muse abandons her devotee. A man I know became seduced by the minor pleasure of doing chores, or at any rate by the absence of pain which they involved, and could be seen from morning till nightfall trotting about his small domain, putting everything in order, setting everything to rights that the slow process of time had disturbed. He was perhaps going too far. To season chores with work and to intersperse them with a few happenings is the secret of a contented existence. Fortunate the man or woman who achieves a just balance between these three types of activity, as I have been able to do by good chance and for a little space of time.
Listening in and speaking out. The importance of being interested. Part 1. By H. Addington Bruce. Many years ago, there lived in the city of Boston a small boy whose days were spent in a singularly wearisome way. At the age of 10, when most boys are dividing their time between school and play, he was busy all day boiling soap, cutting wicks for tallow candles, filling candle molds, and otherwise drudging an assistant to his father in the soap and candle business. It was a business in which the father took an honest pride, and in thus apprenticing his youngest son to it. He did so with the expectation of giving him full charge and ownership in later years. As it happened, the son's mind was filled with thoughts of other things than soap and candles. He worked faithfully enough at the kettles and wicks and molds, but he worked with such scant enthusiasm and such little skill that his father soon perceived that he would never become an expert candlemaker. Bitterly disappointed, he nevertheless appreciated the folly of compelling his son to persist in an occupation clearly inappropriate to him. To another and much older son, he one day said, "Will you take Ben into your printing shop? He will never be a successful chandler, but he may make a fair printer. At any rate, I wish you would give him a chance." Into the printing shop, accordingly, young Ben went, somewhat against his will, for the handling of inky type seemed to him only a little less unpleasant than dealing with greasy molds. But he presently made the important discovery that through typesetting he was in a position both to gain knowledge for himself and to make knowledge available for other people by putting it into print. Therefore, he became interested in printing as he had never been in candle-making. Also, he became fired with a desire to learn all he could about as many subjects as possible. And he developed, besides, an ambition to turn author and see his own thoughts take form on the printed page. Behold him, then, sometimes sitting up the whole night long over Plutarch's Lives, The Spectator, Locke's Essays, and kindred works of information and literary power. Behold him in the fervor of his zeal turning vegetarian at the age of 16 because the greater cheapness of his meals would allow him more money for books. Behold him scribbling and rescribbling in the effort to give clear expression to the ideas forming in his mind as a result of his wide reading and hard thinking. Finally, behold him timidly slipping under the door of his brother's newspaper office an unsigned essay written in a disguised hand. An essay so good that on publication its authorship was variously ascribed to leading writers of the day. Therefore, he toiled more industriously than ever, printing, reading, thinking, writing. Before he was 30, he was widely known, and long before his death, he was recognized on two continents as one of the wisest of men. We of today, looking back from the vantage point of more than a century later, feel that the praise of his contemporaries was not misplaced. For the former candlemaker, who thus rose to eminence, was none other than Benjamin Franklin. Philosopher, scientist, diplomat, and apostle of America's freedom.